listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. You're on the book. So tonight we welcome Common, a.k.a. Lonnie Rashid Lynn. He is best known as a star recording artist whose music is marked, as you know, by intensity and passion. He's also a children's book publisher and a music producer and a television and film actor. He wrote his first rap verse when he was 12, when he was growing up on Chicago's tough South Side. He writes, "I was attracted to hip-hop because of the rhythm, but the words were the reason I fell in love for keeps." He carries on a great tradition of rappers, of great rappers, but also a tradition of Miles Davis, James Baldwin, Bob Marley. "We are the children of jazz," he writes. "We are the children of all black art around the globe." And he wrote that in the afterword to the very wonderful Anthology of Rap. In addition to being a two-time Grammy Award winner, he's earned a reputation in the hip-hop world as a conscious artist by embracing themes of love and struggle in his songs. And in his revealing new memoir, One Day It'll All Make Sense, you'll meet Common the rapper, the actor, the activist, but also the father, the son, and the friend. The great writer James McBride, who's also been at this library, who wrote that great book, The Color of Water, writes of Common's new memoir, "Common distinguishes himself here as a true artist and a writer of deep talent. The book is the story of an artist in constant evolution, one who embodies the strength of the brilliant woman that raised him, the love of the South Side Chicago that spawned him, and the raw spirit of the pro basketball player who fathered him. I've always heard that the people of South Side Chicago were special, and I'm glad their native son Common shows us why." Tonight, Common's in conversation with Kevin Fraser, who just began his first season as co-host of The Insider. For the last 8 seasons, he's worked on a sister show, Entertainment Tonight. You've probably seen him there as correspondent and weekend anchor. He's also done a lot of sports broadcasting, ESPN Sports Center. And we are very, very happy to welcome Kevin Fraser and Common to the Los Angeles Public Library. Please welcome them now.
Thank you, sir. Oh, wow. How's everybody doing tonight? Good?
Good. What's going on?
It's exciting to have them here, isn't it? Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, right off the bat, I want to start with, why did you decide to write a book?
Well, actually, it wasn't my idea. And when I was first approached by my manager, Derek, he was like, "Man, you should write a book." And I'm like, "I'm too young to write a book, man. I still got a career, man. What you talking about?" But and, you know, after further discussion and me just thinking about it, you know, the perspective we wanted to take on the book was just about my life. And this is really like the first chapter of my life. And just the relationship with my mother and the lessons I learned from the things that shaped me, and I wanted to share that with people because my motivation came for writing a book was really like saying, let me express myself and tell my stories and my ups and downs, and hopefully it can motivate someone just because then maybe they could relate to an aspect of me or aspect of the story and just realize that, you know, shoot, we all just human, because this book is about just a young man just coming of age and still learning, you know?
Yeah, does it all make it? One day, it'll all make sense. Does it all make sense now?
Nah, I can't say it all makes sense now. I mean, that's one of the biggest things I think is that, you know, you learn a lot, you grow, and you know, start to know certain things, but you know that you don't know everything. And you know, I don't know what day it will all make sense, but one day it will.
All right, let's go back for a second, and first of all, start with the fact that you wrote a letter to different people and different entities in each chapter. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Well, it was like a collaboration of me writing. I wrote this book with Adam Bradley, who is a great writer, and we had the idea of me writing these letters because we knew it would be even more personal. Because during the process of us writing the book, we would have discussions and we would write things down, and he would ask me questions and just made me really dig into my life and who I was. But these letters, you know, sometimes when you write a letter to someone, it's just like, it's just as raw as possible. You're not editing it. You're just like, hey, your thoughts come out. And that's what these letters were. And it gave like a good preface to each chapter and really made people feel even closer to what the chapters are about and closer to me and people in my life. So these letters, the response from the letters has been great. Like they said, that's a great approach to how we did the book.
You know, the thing is, isn't every album like a book? Isn't a little of you in every album? So,
yeah, actually, each album is it is like a chapter in the book of Common, you know, in the book of Rashid. And you give that, but when you do music, you don't get a chance to really like embellish and just really elaborate and just go in depth, because you know with music it's a certain amount of time. It's bars, you know, when you're writing and describing this story, you know, of course I would love for my stories and songs to be as descriptive, but you can go so much in depth when you're writing a book. And that's what I discovered, you know, writing my first book of this nature.
All right, what's the one thing, and we'll start with a kind of tough question. What's the one thing that you put in here that was tough to put in here?
I think probably the toughest thing was about my relationship with Erykah Badu and like that breakup, because it's you know, that's a real personal situation you go through. And I talked about it somewhat in songs and indirectly, because I talk about love and really loving yourself and those things, and some of that spawned from just me discovering that in that relationship and in that breakup. But to go into detail about the breakup and details about relationships, it's like, man, you open yourself up to a lot of things.
I got
to
be honest with you. I did jump to the relationship part. Right? I did. You know.
Yeah.
I was on the red carpet, and I kid him all the time about his relationships. And that was where I kind of started the book.
Yeah.
How did that relationship shape you? Let's start with Erykah.
Well, that relationship taught me something about myself. It taught me that it was something, a trait that I had throughout my life that I was willing to do, was really kind of when I was around people like that wanted to, like, that had a strong personality, a strong light or whatever, I was willing to dim my light, you know, and just be like, okay, second, I almost play second fiddle to not offend anybody, to not, you know, like whoever it was, it could be one of my close friends who's just like, you know, I let them take the front part of the stage. And at times I would like take away from myself and not really be myself, because I felt like, man, I'm making this person feel bad. I don't want them to feel like I'm trying to get in front of them and take their light. And I kind of, that happened in that relationship, to be honest, where it was like, you know, I was just like, okay, cool. I think I'm doing the right thing. I'm just going to go ahead and let you do this. And I'm, you know, sometimes a man, you just got to give it to a woman and just be like, all right, do your thing, you know. But sometimes as a man, you got to say, hey, this is what it is. All right, this is what we're doing, you know, and just take charge. Right. That's just part of it. Hey, I mean, I hope ladies like a man that'll take charge when necessary. You know what I'm saying? You still got to express yourself.
I will say this. One day you'll get married and you'll lose all control. The reality will set in. It's a new reality.
Well, I got to say, okay, within that, at the end of that, I really learned, like, that made me examine myself and say, man, throughout your life, at times you were just willing to be like, oh, okay, cool, you know, you shine. But I really learned that, man, if God gives you a light, you got to let it shine, no matter where you are, no matter who's in the room with you. It's yours to let it shine, and you can't keep it under. You know, it's a Bible verse that say, you know, you don't keep the light under the lampstand. You put it on the lampstand so everybody can see it when they walk in the room. And there's nothing the matter with being able people seeing your light when they walk in the room. It's not. It shouldn't take away from anybody else's light. You just do your thing. So that's what I learned, and I had to apply that in my relationships too.
I'm going to leave your relationships alone for a second.
One second.
But I do. Another interesting part about this book is your father.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize what a great basketball player he was. Yeah. But you also tell the two sides of your leaving Chicago.
Yeah.
Let me say.
Yeah.
Your mother says you were kidnapped.
Yeah.
Your father was like, no, you just came along.
Right. Yeah, well, yeah, it was two sides to the story. But, I mean, my father, he's from Chicago, and he played ball and was a great ball player. At a certain point in his career, things didn't work out. He played in the ABA for a couple of years, and then things didn't work out, and he started getting in trouble, you know, different drug problems and things like that. And that's when my father and mother separated, and I was very young. But he had got a call from one of his friends who played ball, Spencer Haywood, and told him he can get a tryout. He helped him get a tryout for the Seattle Supersonics. So he said, come out there, but come with your family, because coach like, you know, to see family men, you know.
Right.
And so my father, you know, even though he and my mother weren't together, he came and got us. And whether you call it kidnap or not, he had a gun with him. It was like, come on. He like, come on. So,
like,
so they at a certain point, we riding, and he got his gun sitting right there. And you know, my mother just calculated everything, figured out, you know, she didn't know what was going to happen. No, she, you know, she as she tells it too, she says, you know, she knows, in her heart, she feel like, yeah, he's not going to do any damage to us, probably. But when people are dealing with drugs, you just don't know what they might do, you know? So she calculated things and said, told him she had a headache. And to stop and get some Tylenol, he got the Tylenol. She slipped all this Tylenol, his drink, and he drank, you know, drank his little Coke, his pop, and he passed out. And when he passed out, that's when we escaped, you know? So it was her plan. Either way it goes, she probably either saved our life or maybe messed up, you know, his chances of getting in the league. But we never know. But
right.
But it's just, you know, that's the story.
It's something else, isn't it?
Yeah.
I want to also, how did that, you know, growing up in Chicago, how did it shape you? Because Chicago is like, it's in you. It's a part of you. It's to your core, whether it's being a ball boy for the Bulls.
Yes. Yeah.
Being in the neighborhood, and you still have your friends from Chicago close to you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, Chicago is a very unique city in the way that it's a city, but you still feel like a little bit of a southern warmth, and I think because some of that comes from our roots in Chicago, a lot of our ancestry comes from the south. But it's a warm city. It's a blue collar city. It's very like authentic in a way that, you know, the way I grew up was like, hey. You know, if you had a big head, you got a big head. You ain't scared to say, you know, like when people joke, yeah. You know, you just kind of accept who you are. That's what it was. And, I mean, it taught me a lot about kind of loving myself, too, in Chicago. But it's a very soulful city. And, you know, growing up, like, I grew up in a like, middle-class area, but it was gang-banging, it was drugs. But then again, I went to a good school. So I kind of had to... the balance of life in that way. And Chicago provides that. And then we also have very great music and just a lot of good experiences. From the Bulls winning to just, you know, our city bringing, you know, when I always brag on Chicago, I talk about some of the artists that have come from Chicago throughout history, whether it's Earth, Wind & Fire or Chaka Khan or Minnie Riperton and artists of that nature, Curtis Mayfield. So we got a rich history of musicians and just, you know, whether you go from Oprah to Barack to Michael Jordan, they all come to Chicago to get some love, you know?
You mentioned Michael because you were a ball boy for the great Bulls teams and times.
Yes. That was one of the most fun experiences of my life. You know, I was a ball boy and I was there when Michael Jordan like first came to the league, and it was like one of those situations where you see somebody just blossom into being the greatest ever. I mean, I didn't. Yeah. By the time they were reaching and getting the rings, I was a little too old to be a ball boy. So I was like, but I, during those years of him just even first playing, it was just. I mean, I can remember getting, you know, his gym shoes and like, you know, I would at the time I would go to my math teacher, and if I got in trouble, I would trade the gym shoes for not getting in trouble.
The Jordans.
Yeah, for real.
Like, Jordans.
And my father still has a pair of Jordans that came straight from Mike. And he signed them, you know, it was right after the All-Star game, and they wanted the first pair of Jordans. So I used to get a lot of gym shoes, and I was selling for like $10, $15.
What were you thinking?
I mean, I ain't know any better. For that, for me, that was nice little money to have for lunch and everything. You know?
You were like, I've made the money.
Yeah.
When did words become so important to you and
and
music?
I think words were always important to me in a certain way, because, I mean, whether it was the words that my mother said to me and just, you know, words that my father even said growing up, they always were significant. And I can remember being in certain classes and, like, reading, like, James Baldwin or Langston Hughes, and that, it, like, invigorated me. It made me feel, like, energized and warm and, like, this is something that's good. So I loved the, like, writing and Richard Wright and even Edgar Allan Poe and people like, you know, writers like that, Ernest Hemingway. I can remember reading some of the stuff and just being intrigued by it. And then the words started coming out of me. I used to write and, you know, write papers and have to write book reports and stuff. But when I wrote my first rap, that's when it was like, man, these words really, like, I found a voice inside of me that was like, yeah, this is something I really love to do. And that just happened incidentally, just me being with my cousin, and we was in seventh grade. It was the summer of seventh, going into eighth grade, and we just sat around. Was like, man, let's write a rap, because we was all into Run DMC and LL. Yeah. So we just decided to write raps.
So you're just sitting around, and you're like, we're gonna write a rap.
Let's write a rap.
Let's go.
That's all it. Right. And when I wrote it, it was like the first rap, and then everybody who around our neighborhood who heard it, they kind of caught on, and it made me feel like they always like, man, that's good right there. So it made me feel like, yo, I could do this, you know. I got something, you know.
When did you know it was real though?
Real, I knew it was real. Man, I probably start. Honestly, I ain't start feeling like it was really, really real until I came out with I Used to Love Her, and that was my second album. But it was that, you know, we all had it sometimes, that little instinct that we got something. But I always look at things like, man, until you could have something, but until you start really believing it, then it won't pay off for you, you know, or it won't come into the fruition the way it can if you don't really believe in it. And I'm saying, when I first was doing my first projects, I don't know if I totally believed in myself. You know, it was like, I believed I was a good rapper, but I'm talking about like that belief where it just resonates. People like smell it on you, you know, it's like, and it's nothing to be, and it's just something that's inside of you. It's like, hey, I can do this, you know, and that belief started happening with I Used to Love Her and those, you know, that album, Resurrection.
So many people, you know, and you look at the images we see from rap music today.
Yeah.
And some of those negative images we see from rap music, and you portray a very positive image. How do you balance that whole, you know, everybody in the rap world feels that sometimes that you have to be a certain way. You have to portray a certain thing.
Yeah. I think the way, like I said, the way I was raised was to be yourself. So I never came out like, man, I'm this super gangster. Like, you know, like,
right.
And you know, it's funny, some of my friends would always say, like, man, you don't be telling, you know, some of the street stuff you did. I'm like, you know, like, what's the purpose? You know, at this point, like, what is it going to do? You know, and I always got into this I got into hip-hop because I loved writing. I loved being creative. And then eventually I loved to uplift. So I figured, man, you know, why would I tell stories that about the same thing that somebody else telling, and it's not really like, it's not really adding on to the culture. It's not really adding on to anybody's life. It ain't helping. It don't even make me feel good. Because the good one thing about hip-hop is that when it's true hip-hop, it makes you feel good. Like, you feel, like, spirited and inspired. And that's why, you know, sometimes you hear people, including myself, sometimes be like, man, I don't listen to hip-hop as much because I don't get that inspiration that I once got from it. It's not that I feel like there's nobody out there with talent. It's people out there with talent. It's people that it's hip hop. Some people making some creative things, but it's the spirit that comes with it too. Like the purpose you're doing it for. And if it's really just motivated in money or motivated in, man, this is, I'm about to get this paper and get these cars, it don't have that spirit of what hip hop really started with. And I think, you know, for me, it was always about coming from that spirit and just coming from the heart and making something that's gonna spark people.
That's great. No, that is great stuff.
Thank you.
When did you realize you could make the transition and become a movie star?
Yeah.
When did you, because it's interesting seeing you on the red carpet and seeing you, you know,
yeah,
in these movies and junkets. And
you know what? My first thing was first was that I wanted to be an actor, not just an actor. I felt like if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it at the highest level. But I knew it was a process as far as, like, look, I just started studying acting first. Just going to classes. And I was just enjoying classes in between touring, in between doing whatever work I had to do to pay the bills and doing music. I was going to acting class. The acting class was really, like, fulfilling me. I was, like, looking forward to it. We trudged through the snow, do whatever we had to do to go to classes. And from there, from the classes, I started getting on auditions and started getting better with auditioning. And the time I really realized that I felt, like in my heart, I knew I could be a movie star. I could be a leading man. I felt that in my heart. But the time I realized it was like when I got my first film and I was at the movie theater and I was like, man, I'm on the screen right now. This is crazy. Like, I just, you know, at a certain point was able to separate being so judgmental. I was like, man, I really can do this. I feel like I can do this. I knew it's going to take work, and I'm willing to put in the work because I'm passionate about it. And, you know, I just believe in myself. So I think it was the first time I saw Smoke and Aces is when I was like, yeah, I mean, I could do it for real.
No, I hear you. How much work does it take to be successful in this business all around? Because I think sometimes people look and they're like, I can rap. I should be as successful as you.
Yeah. I mean, people, well, I just say it's work. It's work in a way that, like, you have to work to at your craft or whatever you do. You got to work at that, like, and that. But that should be something that you really love, and you should enjoy that work. But then beyond the work that the creative work that you do and the thing that you really love to do, you have to work to get the music out there or get the product out there or to get the role. You have to go out and do so much work beyond just the creative part to get your material out there. And I mean, you just don't live a regular life. Like, I just, like, for about 8 years, I think I've been coming home, like, living out of my toiletry bag and not really, like, feeling like I could. I don't even unpack bags sometimes. And, you know, you get used to sleeping on planes and stuff start feeling like regular just because of the work and the time you got to put in. It's, yo, people think, like, I mean, even acting, man, people think, like, yo, it's just easy. But you could sit around just for, I mean, you could work 18 hours a day. Not just the actors. I'm talking about the crew, the people, you know, the people that do the catering. It's like the hours are really crazy. But when you love it, you do it. It's like you do it because you love it. And all the benefits come later. And you know, no matter what I'm doing, like, because I love it, I might be tired or whatever, but I ain't going to sit there and complain because I know that I'm grateful to be able to have the opportunity to do it. And I know I want to keep taking it to the next level. But the work is beyond probably your imagination, what you would think, you know.
I want to ask you about a couple of things before we take some questions. But yeah, let's talk about this whole White House thing real quick.
Yeah.
You and the interesting thing is you went for the Christmas tree lighting. See, mm-hmm. People forget that.
That's what I was.
Right. You were there for the Christmas tree lighting, hosted the whole thing, and nobody cared.
Yeah, exactly.
But then you came back to recite some poetry, and I guess that's a big deal if you walk in the White House and recite poetry. What was it like for you to see those negative things and turn on the TV and hear some of the pundits talking about
it? Well, it was – first, I didn't even – no, because I'm not like an avid TV watcher, so I didn't know what was going on. Like, I was working on this independent film, and I got a text from one of my friends, like, man, don't worry about what they're saying about you. I'm thinking like maybe something came out on one of the websites or something, you know. TMZ said something about me. I don't know. Somebody said something, I don't know. I was like, okay, who said something? Then next thing, I kept getting more texts, like, man, they just don't know you or something. So then I got a call, you know, I talked with my manager and a couple of my team, and they was like, man, you know, Sarah Palin came out and said this, and Fox News is saying this. And I was like, I kind of was laughing a little bit, like, you sure? Like, they said me? Wait, so eventually, as it kept going, I felt, you know, at first it was funny, and then I started feeling like, man, this is sad that, you know, that they would take, you know, a piece of what I do and try to skew it to make me look a certain way, you know, and they don't really know me. And out of all the body of work that I've done, they take a piece and say, man, this is what this guy is. And it just, you know, it made me feel like, man, America, man, we get so judgmental about things, and like, we quick to look at, like, you can have a whole life long of doing something positive, but once you do something that, and first of all, I'm being clear that the music that I made was never about like killing cops, or, I mean, I will raise awareness about police brutality. I will speak up for the oppressed and for injustice. I will continue to do that. Yeah. But we have a tendency in America to be like, man, this person, like, we look at the one little speck of dust in somebody's eye, you know, and be like, oh, you got that right there. And, you know, and it's like all this greatness about them, but we look at that. So it was really just a situation where they really didn't know who I was.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the research that they did wasn't as in-depth enough. So their misinformation just eventually, to most people, didn't look valid. It just wasn't valid. And right. For those that didn't know me, maybe for a second they were like, or maybe for a minute they were like, hey, this common guy is no good. But, you know, at some point, you know, they'll discover who I am. And more than anything, you know, you just have to continue doing what you do and know what your mission is, because people will always talk and say something. Mm-hmm. And if you stop for every time somebody say something about you, man, you will get nowhere.
That's the truth. Yeah. By the way, what did the president say to you? I'm just curious. What did our president say to you?
The president just told me, man, thank you for coming. And man, he just gave me love more than anything. It was like, he just gave me that smile. Like, you know, he didn't get too in depth with it. But, I mean, but he gave me that smile. Like, sorry you had to go through this. but you know, the performance we did at the White House is like one of the most monumental moments in my career, in my life. And
what was it like being in the White House?
I mean, it was like an out-of-body experience, for the fact that, you know, when they first introduced me, I'm already was a little nervous because we in the White House about to perform for the president. And as you mentioned, I hosted the White House event. I did a Christmas event with them even the previous year. But I don't know, something about this moment, and all with all the hoopla and the fact that they still let me come, I felt great that they was like, yo, they didn't change their agenda. And when they introduced me, the people just gave such a warm welcome. And I walked out and I had one of my musicians playing, and my DJ was playing Martin Luther King's speech and scratching it. And when I sat on that stool, it was like, I just looked at the president and the first lady, and it was a room just full of people that were supporting it. And I just remember just saying this rhyme/poem, and I was like, man, I'm at the White House talking about the struggle of young people in Chicago and how we got to do better to help raise them. And it was real poetry, and it just felt so fulfilling to my life and career.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. And by the way, I do want to point out that during the Christmas tree lighting, the program was live. And they mistimed it, or somebody, one group couldn't get, they couldn't get B.B. King off
B.
the stage.
King, yeah.
They couldn't get him off the stage fast enough, so they went back to Common, and they just said, do something. And you freestyled a Christmas rap.
Yeah.
That was unbelievable to fill the 2 minutes of time.
Yeah.
And everybody was so entertained. It was great.
Thank you.
It was a great moment.
I appreciate
that people don't even realize, but they were like fighting to get BB off the stage. They're like, come on.
I was like, hurry up, y'all.
And they couldn't get him off the stage.
Yeah.
There's some other things in this book that are pretty amazing. You know I got to ask you about Serena.
Yeah. I love you.
Hey, what?
Yeah.
Well, you tell everybody what that relationship was like.
Man, that was a beautiful relationship. Like, Serena is just a lovely person. Like, she's fun. She's smart. Just a good woman, man, really, to be honest. And just a great support. Like, she supports. And just, man, we just had a great time. A great, like, time together. And that was, you know, it was really fulfilling for me. I learned a lot. And, man, that was great.
Was it weird waking up? And, like, you're in London, and your picture's all over the world. You're just like, I'm going to the car, and there's pictures of you all over the planet.
Yeah, that was pretty weird to me because, you know, that night, like, we were just out having fun. Like, we were touring with Kanye, and it was just like we were having fun. I didn't remember. I do kind of remember the paparazzi coming around, but I didn't know they got all those pictures, and it was like, but we were just like having a good time, and it was weird to experience that. And that was the wake up call for me to be like, okay, I know when you're in a relationship with a celebrity during this time, you know, during this day and time, you have to, you know, just be mindful, basically, and that's what I did because I respect her so much. I never would want. First of all, I respect myself and respect her too, and would never want either one of us to be out, you know, out there showing the bad light. And I mean, you know, I like to party too, but you know, you're coming in from partying and they catch you, you know, they might catch you with a bottle in your hand or something, you know, anything. But the point is, I just try to be respectful to us and try to keep everything close and private.
You had water in your hand. That's all it really
water,
was.
Water. That's
it
what
was
it
a jug
was
of water,
yeah.
Right. No, it was a jug of water.
Yeah, exactly.
Before we take some questions real quick, your mom is so important to you, and people may not realize that how close she is to you, how much she, you know, whenever you have the chance, she's around, and it's just interesting to watch that relationship and watch in such a great, respectful way that you kind of honor her whenever she's around.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my mother is like, she's been my foundation in a way that she provided me with the love, from the beginning, love, and she gave me discipline, taught me a lot of things about just even through example of her, the way she gave to people as a teacher. I saw like a lot of people that she would bring into the house or just be cool with and try to instruct. And I mean, the love I got from my mother really taught me how to love in a way. And it made me, you know, helped me to love myself and know how to love a woman in many ways. And gave me a great model for the type of woman that I would want. And she, you know, she just shaped me, man. And it's nothing like getting love in a home. And it made me want to help other people because I realized that, like, I realized that the love that I received was, like, something that I've seen some of my friends didn't have the opportunity to get. Like, some of my friends, their parents had died. Some of them parents were on drugs. And we always would, you know, my mother would kind of try to take them in and help them out too. And when I see them not having that type of love, I was like, man, I want to be able to give back, you know, so because kids need it.
Yeah.
You know, kids need it. So the love I got, you know, and the relationship I got with my mother is definitely been one of the biggest reasons I'm here and I can be the person I am right now.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I know it is. So it's so amazing because and I know Derek, your manager's out here.
Yes.
Derek is out here and your mom and Derek's parents and everything. It's a tight-knit unit, you know.
Yes.
And it's so wild when you're around them because it's just like a regular family atmosphere.
Yeah.
You're like, where's Rasheed?
Yeah.
And Derek's mom is cooking, so it's a great thing. And you see how family makes such a big difference in people's lives. Yeah. All right, let's take some questions because we're running out of time. But okay.
Yeah.
Hey, what's up, Common?
How you
Thanks
doing?
Thanks for being here. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Are you familiar with KRS's Gospel of Hip Hop?
No, I mean, I'm familiar with KRS, but not the Gospel of Hip Hop.
Okay, so he came out with that, I think, in 2009, and it's documents like hip hop as a spirit-guided intelligence movement,
mm-hmm.
and that upraised like people that had dead ends that didn't really have options, and it gave them elements to express themselves, like beatbox and DJing, flowing, graffiti art, everything dancing. And one theory he has is that Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech outlined the movement of hip-hop from the Northeast all the way through the Midwest to the West.
I won't cut you off, but okay. I want to ask him
so, like, what do you think? What do you think, how is hip-hop going to progress, and is it going to go back to its fundamental roots with, like, another layer, or what do you see the future of hip-hop as?
Well, I mean, thanks. I would hope for hip-hop to continue to progress, and I don't think it'll ever, go back, because hip-hop is like a living organism, just like we live, like, we develop and grow. So, I can't go back to being 4 years old, but I can still keep the child spirit in me, and I think hip hop should be able to keep some of the fundamental spirit of it and just what it was about. But you still have, like you said, new layers to it, because, the world is evolving and changing. So you have to allow hip hop to change and evolve too. And I just would like to see the diversity in it. And more than anything, just see people making music, that hip-hop music, that really care for the art. Because if you care for it, then you're going to put your all into it, and that in turn is going to make the art better.
Mm-hmm. In your opinion, what's the biggest challenge in the world, and how, through your music and through your celebrity, do you think we can address it?
Whoa. Well, we're going to go ahead and figure that one out.
I think one of the biggest challenges in the world is just being able to love, man. Like, because, like, I think when you really do love, like when you love yourself, then you really don't look at other people. You don't look down on them. You just kind of, like, able to love them, like, because you don't feel like you got anything to lose by giving them love. And if you really, like, put love in the forefront of things that you do towards others. Just think, if countries approach things in that way, or, I mean, it will never, well, I ain't gonna say it never happen, but if corporations approach things, and I know, that exactly. So, I mean, but I'm saying, like, the aspect of love is, I think, is one of the most important antidotes we can have to help and cure whatever's going on in the world, because, like, I think that's what helps us to breathe and live. And, I mean, what I try to do is just put it out there, whether I put it out in my music, whether I put it out through the book, and acting. I can't say I put it out in everything. I love acting. I'm passionate about it. But I guess if you see me shooting somebody and smoking aces, they ain't really love, huh?
Yeah.
But I mean, I think love is that antidote, if I could offer my own perspective.
No, or Street Kings, where you had that menacing.
Oh, yeah, that was it.
Or menacing Street Kings. Here we go.
Yes, good evening. Hi, Rashid.
How you doing?
Saw you in the bathroom earlier, Philip.
Yeah. All right.
That really was.
I washed my hands with it.
I opened the door, man. And, like, I said, hey, but here's the star of the show. I said, hey, what's up, brother? Anyway, Rashid, I wanted to ask you. I told you about my father being a jazz musician, but the levels of where jazz has kind of gone from jazz to bebop, and it is a predecessor for what your brand of music is or style, but how much did it really influence you, and where do you think it's going to be to the point where it'll keep influencing you?
Jazz music?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Well, I got to say, hip-hop brought jazz to me because I grew up in a city, of course, where jazz and blues was strong, but I was mostly introduced to soul music, hip-hop music, house music. Now, when Tribe Called Quest came out and they were using jazz samples, I was, like, really interested in jazz. I started going out to do digging for records, and they were jazz records. That's when I discovered the Herbie Hancocks. That's when I discovered the Jazz Messengers and Freddie Hubbard and, you know, all these great musicians. Got on to John Coltrane and Miles Davis and, you know, Mulgrew Miller, who was a newer sound. But I was discovering a lot of music, and I think that, right, you know, even on my way out here, I was listening to the jazz station because I just love jazz music. And it will always have a place in my life and in my music collection. You know, it's definitely one of the, like, I put Love Supreme as one of my top five albums ever made, you know. So it will always have some type of influence on me. And that freedom, you know, I just actually got to perform in Detroit with a great musician friend of mine named Kareem Riggins at their jazz festival. And I was, the freedom that I had when I was rapping with them over this jazz music, it reminded me of what I should be doing in hip-hop. Because, so, you know, sometimes in hip-hop, I started feeling structured and just, okay, you need to do 16 bars and then the chorus. 16 bars and then the next chorus. A bridge, then a verse. You know, it's like, oh, that's the format. But, you know, jazz is so free and music should be free. That I kind of, it kind of reminded me. So I always keep jazz in my heart and let it be some type of influence on me.
It's true American art.
Oh, yes, sir.
Yes, indeed. All right, right up here. You weren't in the bathroom, right? No, just you. Okay. No, I'm messing with you. I'm just messing with
you. Hey, thank you much, brother, for representing. And that's what I want to ask you about. You mentioned Michael Jordan, and I'm not here to get you to criticize anybody, and there's like the athlete Muhammad Ali, you know, to like different ends of the spectrum. Number one, I want to ask you, what do your people, your advisors, advise you to do? And two, have there been any things that you've lost as a result of you taking a principled stand about the issues that impact all of us?
Yeah, I definitely feel, I mean, you know, my advisors, they ask me to do sometimes some of the best things for me. Sometimes it's their perspective of what they think is best for me. And it's up to me as a human being to say certain things just don't fit with my moral code. And I won't do them. And, you know, a funny story is I was, like, this was years ago, like, maybe 10 years ago, I was, Coca-Cola offered me a commercial, and I was like, man, I don't want to do it. And then I was like, they had all of these big wigs call me and have phone conferences. It's like, man, you need to do this. And everybody on my team was like, you need to do this. And I remember, like, I was definitely into my health thing, and my cousin, my whole family was telling me, my mother was calling me like, man, you need to do this. So and my cousin was coming up the stairs to tell me I need to do it. And I was like, man, I don't even drink pop. And I was sitting there drinking the ginger ale at the time. And he's like, you do drink pop. You're drinking one now. But I was like, I don't drink Coke. And he was, and then I turned him down and told him, man, I didn't want to do it. And eventually they came back again and they doubled the money, right? So I said, hold up, let me think about this. And eventually, you know, what I did, just because I ended up doing the Coca-Cola commercial, but I got first of all, I had creative direction, so I could do it any way I wanted. I didn't rap not one ounce about Coke. I rapped about being real and the conflict I even had of doing the commercial. And I say that to say, you know, in many ways, if you're going to do something in that form of fashion, you got to stick to who you are. Like, I never planned to bless you. I never planned to be sitting there. I never planned to be rapping under the rock either. I mean, under a rock. I want people to hear what I had to say. And the blessed thing was, I remember one of my mother's friends, when I did this commercial, was like, man, that was the best song you ever made. I was like, what? But the point, I did it, and it was something that I was able to do my way. And if it's something that I feel is detrimental and is not, you know, really destroying people, I'm not going to support that business, or I won't do anything of that nature. But I do have, you know, I do have my moral codes, and I stick to those. And when I do use major platforms or build with corporations, I have to do it where I can stick to who I am and represent what my brand and what I am about. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. We got time. Two more. Go ahead.
Good evening. Now that you're acting and you have written a book, I was wondering if getting into screenwriting or producing is in the cards for you. I see, being in the entertainment business out here, I see a screaming lack of diversity of people of color behind the scenes. So I was wondering if that's something you're interested in having more of a hand in.
Yeah. Yes, very much so. And we have established a film and television production company called Freedom Road, and the independent film I just did, we are on as producers on that, but I'm definitely looking forward to producing more films and TV shows, animated shows, you know, like, that's something we definitely want to be behind the scenes too, because, you know, you just want to diversify and be able to, for me, like, just be able to do business across the board, employ people who deserve it, you know, and just be behind some of my own projects and not have to wait on anybody. Just create things for myself and for my team and for the world eventually, you know?
All right.
Hello, how are you today?
How you doing?
I'm good. I just want to say one thing, that music, your music comes from the right place.
Thank you. I appreciate you
just inspiring myself in my everyday life and everybody that you see and hear in the world. The thing is, I want to know, when did you fall in love with music and what made you happy as a kid?
Yeah. That's good. I fell in love with music probably really around the Michael Jackson era, you know. And I mean, I already liked music and I liked hip hop, but just really falling in love where you're like, man, I love. Because I would hear from my babysitter Marvin Gaye and hear the Commodores and Chaka Khan, but, you know, me going out and getting a record or being like putting a record on was like Stevie Wonder and Michael Jackson. And what made me feel good as a kid was like, honestly, seeing Michael Jackson dancing and Billie Jean and Beat It and those things. It was something called Friday Night Videos or something.
I remember that.
You remember that? Yeah.
When you had to wait all week to see the video.
Yeah, exactly.
I had a VHS machine ready. Push and record.
I'm with you. That made me happy, and playing basketball made me happy as a kid. Yeah.
Awesome. You know what?
One last question.
Okay, we'll take one more. One more.
Remind you that our book signing is going to be in here tonight, and if you want to thank our wonderful guests tonight, if you'll join me in thanking them. And also remind you, if you become a member of the Library Foundation tonight, we do have a signed copy of Common's book to give you as a gift, and we would love for you to become a member at the $100 level and support the Los Angeles Public Library. So our last question, wherever you...
I'll have to bring
it to them? Okay.
Right here.
Yeah, last question. All right, Common, first of all, you're one of my top 10 MCs, even after you serve Ice Cube. You know,
thank
it was you. One of my childhood favorite MCs.
Thank you.
But look, man, I'm a high school teacher just up the street right here.
Yeah.
Miguel Contreras. And, you know, I always try to use hip-hop in some way, and, you know, in the classroom to illustrate, you know, anything going on in America and the world. But, you know, it's getting really hard, you know, I got to compete with, like, you know, Lil Wayne and, like, you know, just a bunch of stuff. So how can I continue to use hip-hop? How can I continue to use hip-hop in the classroom? I don't know, some quick advice you can give me.
I think, obviously sometimes you might have to bring in some music that may be from different eras of hip-hop, but even if you don't do that, I mean, maybe you use, you know, raps in different ways, like you might even end up writing some raps. I know you. I could tell you rap somewhere. you held the mic like, yo.
You saw that, yeah, right? Yeah. You saw that, dude.
Yeah. So
I thought he was gonna do last question rap.
Last question. Yeah. You might have to implement that. Like, bring some raps in for yourself, or just have the kids start writing a rap that relates to that project. You know what I'm saying? He said use some poetry too. So whichever way, but you got to make them feel interested in a part of it. I mean, you know, as a teacher to do that, but let them write some raps about a certain subject. Yeah.
Awesome. All
right. Come in. Allowed is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Allowed theme was composed by Larry Karish.